It is Monday, March 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, North Korean media has not commented on U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to meet with Kim Jong-un. Former White House strategist Steve Bannon speaks at a French far-right party conference, and famed French couturier Hubert de Givenchy dies at the age of 91. It's all ahead. Since Thursday's announcement that President Donald Trump had agreed to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, there has been no sign about it in state-run media in North Korea. South Korean Unification Ministry spokesman Park Tae-hoon said the silence may signal that Pyongyang is approaching this matter with caution and needs time to organize its position. Sunday on U.S. television, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was asked on NBC's Meet the Press what has changed since President Donald Trump famously said talking with North Korea is a waste of time.
The president's been very clear in what the objective is here, and that is to get rid of nuclear weapons on the peninsula. We've been executing all year a maximum pressure campaign. It's been very effective. Sanctions has been a big part of that. We've done more sanctions this year than the entire last 10 years. And there's no question these sanctions are working, and that's what's brought them to the table.
Mnuchin said that the maximum pressure campaign will remain in place while the U.S. tries to remove a nuclear threat. The director of Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, said the North has agreed to talk about denuclearization and understands that joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises must proceed as planned next month. But Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sun-Yun Lee tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the notion that North Korea has offered any concessions is absurd.
Kim Jong-un has bamboozled the world. He has really tricked the world into believing that he has sort of made an offer of concession. This latest message via the South Korean envoys that Kim Jong-un in the meantime will refrain from further weapons tests, this is a lazy recycling of the old ruse he used on the Obama administration in 2012. Moreover, we know that nuclear and ballistic missile tests are prohibited under more than 10 UN Security Council resolutions, so the mere utterance of abstinence from illicit forbidden activities is no concession at all.
The Director of Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, insisted that never before have we had the North Koreans in a position where their economy was at such risk, where their leadership was under such pressure. And that's the reason that Kim Jong-un made his offer.
I don't think it's entirely untrue, but it's probably 80% untrue and 20% true. Why? I'm sure Kim Jong-un has been feeling the pinch over the past year, and credit is due where it's due. Mr. Trump is the first U.S. president to enforce sanctions against North Korea in any meaningful way. So he's done the right thing so far. But he has sort of set himself up for a real disgraceful moment in U.S.-North Korea relations by rushing into this meeting and accepting Kim Jong-un's proposal. Because let me ask you this rhetorical question. If that were true, that Kim Jong-un is asking for a summit because of Mr. Trump's very effective hardline financial measures, at what point between Vice President Mike Pence's invalidation of Kim Jong-un's Olympic Games outreach in early February, how Pence characterized this outreach to South Korea as, quote, a charade, and Kim Jong-un's courting of President Trump today in early March? So at what point over the past 30 days or so did the deal leader's intentions become not fake? You know, to say that Kim Jong-un all of a sudden in January had a change of heart because of the sanctions measures, or that until early February he was putting on a charade, but now this outreach, this proposition for a face-to-face meeting is genuine, is not convincing.
Sung-Yun Lee of Tufts University said Kim Jong-un's main objective is an easing of sanctions. He said the biggest mistake Mr. Trump could make is to prematurely lift those sanctions, short of a verifiable pledge to dismantle the North's nuclear arsenal. He said Mr. Trump could walk away with a moral victory by publicly demanding Mr. Kim tear down the walls of his inhumane gulag. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, there's several things trending. One, I thought I'll just mention in passing. We're not going to focus on it. Mr. Trump was at a campaign rally in Pennsylvania for a special election on Saturday. He spoke for about an hour and 15 minutes. He hardly even mentioned the candidate he was there to support. It was it received a lot of attention. Let's just say that Mr. Trump was kind of – it was classic Trump speech, and a lot of people reacting to it. But I thought, you know, we hear a lot about Trump and, you know, the sort of the ongoing daily kind of churn. I thought we'd focus on another world leader, and that's, in this case, Vladimir Putin. Now, Mr. Putin, over the weekend, gave an interview to NBC television, and they asked him, the interviewer asked him about charges of Russian meddling in 2016's election, and the 13 Russian nationals who were indicted were charged by Robert Mueller, I think, about a month ago or so. Mr. Putin responded this way. I couldn't care less because they don't represent the government. I could not care less. They do not represent the interests of the Russian state. But he went on. Maybe they're not even Russians, but Ukrainians, Tatars, Jews, just with Russian citizenship. Even that needs to be checked. This is drawing a lot of angry replies and response. Not that I'm sure Mr. Putin gives one whit about that, but people are saying, you know, look, this invocation of, first off, the invocation of the Jews, at least as the Anti-Defamation League president put it, Jonathan Greenblatt, he said, you know, this comment sounds like as it was ripped from the pages of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was, of course, is a famous fake blood libel kind of publication that came out many, many years ago. But U.S. lawmakers and others are responding as well. Senator Tim Kaine, he says, Putin suggests Jews are to blame for the Russian election interference. Why does our president still cover for this anti-Semitic dictator? Senator Richard Blumenthal, himself also a Democrat, repulsive Putin remark deserves to be denounced soundly and promptly by world leaders. Why is Trump silent? Intolerance is intolerable. Let's see. There's a number of others. I'll kind of pause there because I think you get the idea. A lot of people also focusing on this idea that, you know, Putin seemed to be saying, well, okay, maybe they were Jews with Russian citizenship, but that doesn't make them Russian, which is in itself, you know, a very odd comment. So don't expect him to be called on the carpet for this, at least in his country, by the media. But a lot of people are talking about what some people are finding really unsettling remarks.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Iran accuses the United States of supporting Islamic State in Afghanistan. Washington denies that allegation. President Trump says there's little support for an age limit change for gun buyers. At least 40 people are killed in a Nepal plane crash. And U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson cut short his Africa trip to deal with North Korea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Over the years, the internet and lately social media have proved themselves valuable resources for our daily lives. But the two have also become powerful tools for the unscrupulous to spread disinformation or what some have come to call fake news. A new study published in the journal Science finds that on the popular social media platform Twitter, disinformation travels faster and farther than true or factual material. Researchers discovered that false information was 70% more likely to be retweeted than truthful material. While they found the top 1% of false news would spread regularly between 1,000 to 100,000 people, the truth seldom spread to more than 1,000 people.
The study also finds that political news spreads 3 times faster than other topics. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a former White House staff member speaks to a far-right party in France. Students across the country have been protesting school gun violence since the February 14th shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead. On March 14th, the one-month anniversary, a national student walkout is planned to last 17 minutes in commemoration of the victims and as a statement to policymakers. From Washington, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
A national movement sparked following February's high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, in which 17 people were allegedly killed by a former student wielding an AR-15 semi-automatic weapon. For the one-month anniversary of that event, students, teachers, and others from around the country will take part in a 17-minute walkout to honor the victims and draw attention to the issue of school gun violence. On Thursday, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio met with students to discuss the topic. Some of them emphasized student activism as a way of bringing in fresh voices they say are not controlled by the National Rifle Association.
As I turn on the TV and I see all of these mass shootings that I know could have been prevented, I feel like it's my job as someone that could have happened to actually take action and go into that leadership role.
While others signal their support of responsible gun ownership and the Second Amendment, which provides for gun rights in the U.S.
You never know the moment when an armed person can come in. And when an armed person comes in, we need to have somebody ready, such as a school safety officer that is armed and ready to initiate and either like take down the person or maybe even kill the person for the better safety of all the other students.
A march in Washington is planned for March 24th. And another walkout is scheduled for April 20th, the anniversary of the 1999 shooting in Columbine, Colorado. Some school districts have announced they will not recognize the walkouts and will discipline those who participate. Others have offered their support, with some colleges reassuring students that admission offers will not be affected by their participation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Washington.
Continue to speak out!
Former White House strategist Steve Bannon sought to re-energize France's struggling far-right National Front Party over the weekend by speaking at a party congress and telling party leader Marine Le Pen and her nationalist supporters that history is on our side. Bannon's appearance in France was part of a European tour in which he's seeking an international platform for his closed borders anti-foreigner message that helped Donald Trump win the U.S. presidency. VOA's Lori London asked Paris-based journalist Catherine Field what she sees as the motivation and purpose of Bannon's speech in France.
It was really Steve Bannon giving the same speech that he's given everywhere else, which is anti-globalization, anti-immigration, talk about defeating the global elite. It was all of the same simple vision that he's given around the world, but doing it in this arena with Marine Le Pen in the northern French city of Lille really did put him in the spotlight. And it just showed how much of a following Steve Bannon has in Europe. This isn't the first meeting that he's addressed here in Europe. Last week he spoke to a crowded forum in Zurich in Switzerland. He's also been visiting and speaking in Milan in Italy and in Rome in Italy. So he's really been just taking this incredibly simple message of anti-elite, anti-immigrant, and the key phrase that he gave to the speech in France was, history is on our side. He said, every day we get stronger and they are getting weaker.
We heard him say, let them call you racists, let them call you xenophobes, let them call you nativists, wear it as a badge of honor. Is he actually saying that these people should be proud to be racists and xenophobes? Or is he just sort of saying, we don't care what you think?
What he's saying is, the three main pillars of what they believe, which is populism, the ideology that politics is an expression of the will of the people, and nativism, which is the idea that your country is only inhabited by people of your same national group, and the third pillar, which is authoritarianism, you're a strict, ordered society, that these are the values that they can be proud of, and to not waver from these values if people, as he put it, turn them around and say that, well, these are racist policies. You think they might call you that, but that's not what these policies are. What these policies are people standing up to the corrupt elite, and that these people that they are representing are people who have no connections in business and who have just been left out through globalization.
Why is a man who seems to be very motivated to tear down politics as usual in Washington, D.C., turning his sights across the Atlantic?
Europe is really going through a period of, if you like, populist nationalism. And when you look around Europe, particularly Eastern Europe and Scandinavia, you have got a lot of these far-right parties actually in power. I'm referring to Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Austria, Romania, and possibly in the weeks and months ahead in Italy. So you've already got that groundswell of people who are very concerned, who feel that they've been let down. They've seen manufacturing jobs disappearing. They've seen a rise in immigration. They've seen more different religions becoming the norm in their own country. And so this has been on the rise. So for someone like Steve Bannon to come along, who still trades very much on his connections to the White House, even though they have been cut, he trades on that, and it gives, if you like, a sense of respectability to these parties, particularly in Eastern Europe and Scandinavia, who really do cry out for that respectability which he can give them.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist. She was speaking with VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. French designer Hubert de Givenchy has died at his home near Paris at the age of 91. He was known for styles that attracted actress Audrey Hepburn and First Lady Jackie Kennedy. They were among two of his most prominent clients. Valerie Steele is director and chief curator of the museum at the New York-based Fashion Institute of Technology. She tells me about Givenchy's contribution to fashion in the mid to late 20th century.
Hubert de Givenchy was one of a core group of French couturiers who helped make Paris once again the center of fashion after World War II. So he was a younger contemporary of Dior and Balenciaga. And they, of course, were the two lead figures, and Jacques Fass, who died early. But then Givenchy continued when Balenciaga retired. He gave over many of his couture clients to Givenchy, who helped create very elegant, very French feminine styles in haute couture, of course, but also creating ready-to-wear as well.
He was well known for his, I guess, a partnership, or she was his muse, the actress Audrey Hepburn. They seemed to work together a great deal.
Yes. That he's probably most famous for the public for his relationship with Audrey Hepburn. He created many of her clothes, both on and off screen, and she really epitomized his style.
Another famous client of Mr. Givenchy was American First Lady Jackie Kennedy.
Yes, although Jackie technically was not supposed to be wearing non-American designers. She was a great Francophile, had studied in France, and spoke French very well. And she did appear occasionally, particularly on famous visit to France, wearing beautiful Givenchy couture.
Yeah, that is interesting because I remember hearing about that. She ended up wearing, I believe, Oleg Cassini because he had become a naturalized American.
Well, yes, and he copied the Givenchy and other French clothes that she wanted to wear.
How did Givenchy's style evolve over the years?
It became increasingly young and modern. Initially, of course, he was very much the younger partner of people like Dior and Balenciaga, who did very grand clothes that looked back to, in a sense, to the Belle Epoque, even to Versailles and the magnificence of Paris fashion. And as a member of a younger generation, he began to move the clothes towards a younger look, not nearly so radically as someone like Yves Saint Laurent. Nevertheless, he was moving in that direction. And his clothes were always known to be very feminine.
And I believe, wasn't he known for what's called the little black dress?
Well, he, of course, was known for that, but I think partly because Audrey Hepburn famously wore variants of that in a couple of her most famous films.
So did he basically work on, he confined himself to clothes? Did he do any other kinds of, you know, design other products?
I have no idea whether he licensed products. That was something that was beginning to come in with his generation of designers. He probably did license some things, but he was primarily focused on the creation of beautiful women's wear and was also a mentor to some of the younger French designers. When he sold Givenchy, his rights to it, he, I think, was disappointed by then the appearance first of Galliano, then of McQueen, and then of other sort of young Turks at the house of Givenchy because they didn't really continue his very feminine and French style.
That is Valerie Steele. She's director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States salutes the courage and sacrifices of the Afghan security forces and all those countries who are advising and supporting the efforts of the Afghan people. As President Trump noted, the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, the worst in the history of the United States, were planned and directed from an Afghanistan ruled by a Taliban regime that gave support and shelter to terrorists. Today, the goal remains the same, to ensure that Afghanistan is never again used as a safe haven for terrorist groups to attack the United States, the region, or the international community, said U.S. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for South and Central Asian Affairs, Alice Wells. The South Asia strategy President Trump announced is a conditions-based strategy that makes clear to the Taliban that they will not achieve a military victory on the battlefield, but must come to the negotiating table with the Afghan government. The onus of responsibility is now on the Taliban to demonstrate that they are ready to talk to the sovereign and legitimate government and people of Afghanistan. The U.S. position is unambiguous, said Ambassador Wells. We recognize the only way to end the conflict is through a negotiated settlement. The United States will support direct negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban when both sides commit to them. President Ghani has made clear that the Afghan people are ready for peace, but some things are not negotiable. The Afghan people will not sacrifice their safety, legal protections, or human rights to achieve peace. They will not return to the oppression and isolation of the late 1990s. Afghan men and women must remain free to speak their minds, choose their leaders, and help shape government reforms. The international community stands behind President Ghani and the people of Afghanistan. The United States fully supports timely, credible, and transparent elections in 2018 and 2019 as essential to meeting the expectations of the Afghan people. The United States calls on all friends of Afghanistan to fully support the Afghan government and its vision for peace. Continuing a campaign of violence will never win the Taliban the support of the Afghan people and the legitimacy of the international community. it will only continue to discredit them and their cause.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.